الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم everyone and welcome to a new episode of the Qarawiyyin podcast. I'm your host Sara and I'm joined today with my co-host Aisha H. Aisha, how are you doing today?
Alhamdulillah, I'm good Sara, how are you?
I'm good, alhamdulillah. And today we're also joined by a very wonderful special guest. Today we're here with Uthayna Hamda. How are you, Uthayna?
Alhamdulillah, it's good to be here. How are you, Sara? How are you, Aisha?
Alhamdulillah, we're good. I'm really excited to have you on the episode today. Alhamdulillah. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. And just for a bit of background on Uthayna, she's a project assistant with the Umatics Project, which is soon to be the Umatics Institute. You guys may have seen us recommending their colloquiums, which have been going on for the past few months. And she also received her Master of Arts in Sociology and Master of Arts in Political Science from the University of Toledo in Ohio. And today we're going to be talking about the research that she has done as part of her MA in Sociology, specifically on the topics of American Muslim exceptionalism, how that compares to other types of either religious exceptionalism, American nationalism, and we'll go into defining terms as we discuss, but the kind of the underlying theme of this discussion is definitely the particularities of the American Muslim experience, but how that leads to, or how that affects how American Muslims view the concept of the Ummah, how they view other segments of the Ummah. Maybe there are parallels to this experience in other parts of the world. But yeah, I want to start just by asking you, what is American Muslim exceptionalism? And is it different from American exceptionalism or other religious exceptionalisms? Can we just, yeah, start with definitions?
Sure. So, well, I'd like to first start, as you said, by giving a general definition of American exceptionalism, which I think is an idea that has endured until now, even given the decline of the United States economically and militarily on the global stage. American exceptionalism being not just a set of political beliefs, but an ideology in which nationalism and politics are intertwined. And so the origins of American exceptionalism are often traced back to, you know, the early establishment of the American colonies, when early American colonists declared that they would create a, quote, city upon a hill, divinely entrusted with serving as a model for the rest of the world. And the late sociologist Seymour Lipset is often credited with explaining exceptionalism as an ideology that sets the U.S. apart from its fellow, you know, Western liberal democratic countries. And he describes American exceptionalism as a, quote, ideological commitment and, quote, creed consisting of this distinct type of classical liberalism. And so these American values consist of individualism, egalitarianism, anti-statism. So that is liberty, populism, laissez-faire economics. And the other component to American exceptionalism is this belief that the U.S. is inherently distinct from and superior to other nations with this divinely ordained responsibility to influence the world. And I think for the purposes of our discussion today, it's important to think about American exceptionalism as it serves as an iteration of American civil religion. And civil religion is defined as this religious dimension of the public realm, and it provides societies with this unifying set of political, cultural, and social ideals. And in the United States, that is around which the American identity forms. In other words, you know, practices like standing up for the Pledge of Allegiance, upholding and appealing to the U.S. Constitution as this sort of sacred text, respecting, you know, the founding fathers, saying God bless America, as all of the U.S. presidents do or have done, the sacred affirmation of the state, and all of this falls under this concept of civil religion. And so civil religion requires this form of solidarity, this commitment to the responsibilities of citizenship. And one of the debates among scholars who study, you know, this concept is whether civil religion inevitably champions exceptionalism and whether civil religion is this neutral plane that can accommodate other religious minorities. This is because the form that civil religion takes is argued to work best with a particular American variation of religion, that is Protestantism with this Judeo-Christian ethic. And religious nationalists in particular have tended to put these particular ethnic religious boundaries on what it means to be an American. And not just religious nationalists, but much of the American public, especially back during 9/11, when civil religion was used to promote the certain racial, ethnic, cultural, religious feature to American identity. And through civil religion, the state assumes the role of the church in creating these unifying symbols of identity, solidarity, and meaning. and the American political, cultural, and social mores than inevitably direct religious sensibilities. So why does it matter? It's important to remember that exceptionalism as a civil religious ideology was used to justify, misleadingly, of course, the global war on terror, impacting the lives of Muslims globally. And American exceptionalism is not necessarily in retreat, and it's not, I make the argument, it's not the static phenomenon or ideology. Rather, it's being restated and reformulated by recent political events. That includes deep political polarization in the U.S., recently punctuated by the decision on Roe v. Wade, responses to the pandemic, and then the mixed responses to the U.S. withdrawal of troops, the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Afghanistan. And then one way it has evolved is through Trump's rise and the rise of the right-wing populist movement. And Trump's America First positions, they kind of deviated from Bush's positions, and Bush employed this exceptionalist rhetoric to justify the U.S.'s unilateralism and preemptive measures on the so-called war on terror. But Trump still employed a variation, perhaps this, what could be termed this closed version of American exceptionalism, even if it was relatively more isolationist in policy, but still very hubristic in character. Now, when it comes to defining an American Muslim exceptionalism, American Muslims have moved toward forming this unique identity distinct from Muslims abroad, especially following the events of 9/11, but also by American Muslims' greater integration and assimilation. So this sort of exceptionalism challenges the suspicions and assumptions about Muslim disloyalty or anti-American beliefs that have dominated mainstream discourse and cast Muslims in America through the security lens. So American Muslim exceptionalism means positioning Islam as this authentically American religion. And also found within this phenomenon of American Muslim exceptionalism is this indigenization of American Islam, marked by this increased political participation and the cultivation of a distinct American identity that still upholds the classical Islamic tradition. And so we can kind of address the indigenization piece a little bit further later. But I do want to say that American Muslim exceptionalism, of course, has roots in the broader American exceptionalist narrative and discourse. And I think one way it's been described by Zarina Graywell, for example, in her book, Islam is a Foreign Country, she talks about this idea that Muslim reformist activists construct this, quote, national moral geography of the American Medina as home, and that, quote, not only embraces American citizenship, it replaces outsiderhood with American exceptionalism, specifically with this emergent religious narrative that posits American Muslims as the exceptional ummah, recasting American Muslims as leaders and as examples to the Muslim world. And this often translates, where this often translates is the American Muslim self-narrative level. And often when we talk about, for example, American Muslim scholars and leaders and their striking popularity and influence overseas with other Muslims, or rhetorically, for example, when American Muslims say that they're afforded more freedoms in the U.S. and therefore enabled to live out Islam more freely and authentically here. And where it intersects with the most contentious consequence of this narrative, I think, aside military interventions in Muslim countries, is through the absorption of American Muslim leadership and efforts to combat violent extremism, for example, that has put forward this dichotomy of the good Muslim, bad Muslim, or the good moderate American Muslim citizen countering immigrant fundamentalists or extremists. But I think overall, this American exceptionalism discourse is occurring on the level of some, but not all, circles of American Muslim leadership and cultural production and civic engagement. That's how I would summarize American Muslim exceptionalism for now. To answer the other part of your question, I think when I've read on religious exceptionalisms, it's important to consider two angles through which we look at exceptionalisms. The first is the theologies of exceptionalism, or the exceptionalism of particular religious communities, theologically speaking. That would be the equivalent to talking about ummatic exceptionalism, or the notion of the Islamic ummah of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. In the Jewish case, that would mean their conception and belief in their chosenness and their covenant with God. The second is to consider whether religious exceptionalism intersects, or where religious exceptionalism intersects with American exceptionalism, especially in American religious exceptionalism, or this idea that religious practice in the United States looks fundamentally different. Included in this are political questions like what constitutes good or bad religion, and what kind of religious practice is practice that does not conflict with the ethical commitments of American public life. So I make the argument that American Muslim exceptionalism complicates this relationship that Muslims have to their religion by obscuring the boundaries of the identities that they carry as Americans and as Muslims. And so this is a consequence of American Muslims trying to locate a point of entry within the American sociopolitical setting, as it's been informed by civil religious ideals, while being both subsumed by and cast outside this American political commitment and ideal, especially since the events of 9/11. So what I found to be a parallel debate example, just because there's so much literature on this, you know, within the American Jewish literature on exceptionalism, there's a similar debate that exists that whether Jews are in America are in this particularly unique privileged position due to them not having to undergo this, you know, the significant emancipation process in America. So there's literature that talks about the American Jewish community as a success story, with Jewish theological exceptionalism, whether it kind of merges with American exceptionalism successfully, as evidenced by like America's strong Judeo-Christian tradition. But there are scholars that contest that, that argue against it, saying that it's simply a historical inaccuracy to say that, and Jews have been actually subsumed by this myth of a Judeo-Christian tradition. And so that's all to say that there are similar debates that are happening in other religious minority communities. But I don't want to rely too much on the Jewish example, because it's an, you know, it's important to bear in mind the limits of this example, because, for instance, you know, the U.S. has not invaded a Jewish country, or because of the strong U.S.-Israel alliance. And Ann Norton, in her book on the Muslim question, has a quote that, quote, America confronts the Muslim question without the imperative to acceptance. And so I find that overlaps a bit with the argument of American Muslims that they're more free to practice Islam in the U.S. than anywhere else in the world, at least as a religious minority community. And we can talk about, you know, where the shortcomings of this argument exist, of course. But what I found useful is, you know, within the Jewish American literature is this theoretical grounding of exceptionalism, which I think is important for our discussion. So what makes a distinctiveness of a community or a religious community or particularly exceptional or superior? And what are the varieties of exceptionalism that exist? So does a Muslim who firmly believes that they're most free to practice their religion in the U.S., and advocates for that, does that mean that they espouse this exceptionalist outlook? So that's kind of how I would answer that.
That was just, mashallah, like a fascinating summary of what is an extremely deep issue. But I think I've been really impressed, mashallah, Bethina, about how you managed to locate this issue as kind of the locus of, I guess, what a lot of the things that we're kind of seeing now. I think that understanding the role played by American exceptionalism is really important. Given, you know, you mentioned yourself about how kind of the recent political events in the US mean that this is something that is dynamic and it's fluid and it's changing. And I think that very much in the context of the culture wars, understanding the significance that this concept plays in the American psyche really explains why the reactions to issues like abortion, for example, have been the way that they are. I mean, I'm speaking as an outsider here, obviously, and that's why I'm really excited for this conversation, because I think getting your perspective and Sara's perspective will be great, inshallah. But, you know, people, I think, in the UK and in elsewhere in Europe, even non-Muslims, you know, I think are struggling to perhaps understand and locate why has the abortion debate created this much polarization? What is it about America that is different to many other European states where this is democratically voted on? And yes, you have different opinions about it, but it doesn't result in the kinds of scenes and the kinds of legislation that we're seeing in the US. So the fact that kind of you're focusing on this and linking it to those events, I think, is really important. What you were saying about American civil religion as well, is again something I think, just coming from as an outsider, is something that America is known for. Like the idea that, you know, yeah, you stand for the national anthem and, you know, you have to, and you do that every single day in school, is extremely baffling. But I understand how obviously you're saying, you know, it plays into this almost a replacement of the religious identity that does underpin most other modern Western states to some degree. And that relationship is almost kind of an experiment in the making as to, or an experiment as to how a state would be able to reconcile religion and politics in this manner. And that's why, obviously, yeah, America has the position that it does in the world, and that people look to it almost as an example in carrying these kinds of things.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And The first thing that really stands out to me in this discussion is this concept of civil religion in the United States, and how the purported success of the American political system is that there is room for, you know, even some overt expressions of religious symbolism and rhetoric in the American political sphere, but it never goes so far as to breaking that divide between church and state, never goes so far as to really involving religion in politics or imposing one religious group's values on another group. And this is pointed to as evidence of the success of the American political system and how it's perfectly designed for religious minorities to be able to thrive religiously, civilly, politically, and so on. But what it rests on, this idea of civil religion, what it rests on is constructing these particular supposedly universal values that all different religious and non-religious groups are meant to share, and privatizing religion and, you know, crafting the right type of religion that can be voiced, that can be practiced publicly, the right type that can even be practiced privately, because even that is policed and surveyed to an extent. But yeah, I think the further that we delve into that, the more that those internal contradictions of liberal democracy and of capital L liberalism really come to the forefront, where it's pretty much impossible to strike that balance between freedom and religious independent religious practice and also shared universal values. And in addition to that, another way that I think a lot of these internal contradictions really come to the surface is when, for example, discussing that example of American Jewish exceptionalism, which you write about, and how these individual success stories are used as evidence for the correctness and the superiority of the American political system, rather than being seen as what they are, which is exceptions along the way and exceptions in American history. For example, the civil rights movement, I think, is still oftentimes portrayed as something that could happen because of the way the American political system is set up, and not something that had to happen because of the way it's set up, and something a fight that had to take place, and a fight that is not complete because of the way the because of the political system, how it's designed and who it's designed for. And the same thing is done with these individual Muslim success stories, where the Muslim community's achievements, whether I think especially materially, are pointed to as examples of why American democracy works, because anybody can succeed here, including practicing Muslims, including women who wear hijab. I think that gets at why that, you know, whether it's particularly American Muslim exceptionalism or even these other types of American exceptionalisms, contain a lot of internal paradoxes. But I want to transition to asking you about just how on the ground pragmatically this phenomenon has impacted the American Muslim community, and particularly how has it affected how our community views and treats the broader ummah?
Yeah, sure. So I think that while we talk about American Muslim exceptionalism, we're often limited to discussing it as it's developed in kind of leadership spaces or among voices in leadership, just because, you know, we haven't really done like polling with, you know, the average American Muslim, right? So it might be that Muslims in America still very much feel this attachment toward their, you know, their fellow Muslim brothers and sisters or their co-religionists overseas, but that might, they might not be sure how to navigate that, especially given, you know, our community's limited capacity. So I think that, for example, with like the Maddox Project, we'll talk about a little later in detail, inshallah, many Muslims that are engaging with our work are based in the U.S. You know, and so that tells you something. It might be this curiosity, or it might be this real thirst for a real change in our priorities or how we can foster real community or and life meaningfully. So we might also have the reality that, for example, Dr. Joseph Kaminsky writes in his short piece on our on the Maddox website, which is that what he considers that might actually be the obstacle, which is he kind of calls this Muslim disinterested middle, or Muslims who are just not invested enough in questions of the ummah, or who are otherwise politically apathetic. I just wanted to keep that in mind when I'm not in the sense that it's hard to kind of make this like general statement about Muslims in America, but rather just focus on this one very prominent public articulation of what it means to be Muslim in America found on that level of leadership and cultural production. So I'm not the first to, I mean, I'm not, of course, not the first to kind of comment or write on the subject. And I think Abdullah Larian wrote excellent pieces on Al Jazeera's website and in Muftah magazine, which can be found online. And I highly encourage everyone to read. And he focuses on these, he writes on these issues with a focus on the mass securitization of Muslim Americans and the structural Islamophobia at post 9/11. And not only have Muslims in America been severely restrained from taking any sustained meaningful action for their local Muslim communities that were under surveillance post 9/11, let alone advocate for Muslims overseas impacted by U.S. imperialism. So that renders like the U.S. Muslim communities institutions very weak. And even in select cases, complicit in, for example, like CVE or countering violent extremism programs. So as a result, American Muslim institutional priorities have changed, whether they felt pushed in a corner to shift or otherwise. And their work tends to align more so with mainstream American culture wars. And their political advocacy for their Muslim brothers and sisters was then limited to events like Trump's Muslim ban, which echoed acceptable mainstream political advocacy that was happening at the time. Otherwise, no facet of activism has been untouched or neutralized by this. You know, whether it's like charitable foundations being criminalized, like the Holy Land Foundation or Kind Hearts Foundations and shut down, or well-established organizations like CARE and ISNA being named unindicted co-conspirators in the, you know, in the Holy Land Foundation trial, which actually means nothing as a term, but just meant to kind of put those organizations in negative light. So I think, you know, by and large, Muslim American institutions have been, you know, have as a result become, you know, very weak and limited in what they're able to advocate for, you know, whether domestically or, you know, with respect to foreign issues. And so they're left in this very like conflicted position as a result.
Yeah, definitely. I think that point about how American Muslim political advocacy has started to fall more and more into the dichotomies and categories that are constructed by, you know, contemporary American culture wars is so important, because it helps us dismantle that illusion that we are genuinely able to articulate authentic Islamic values and positions within the American political sphere. Because even the arguments that we are largely making and the rhetoric that we use, the labels that we put on things, the people that we align with, these are positions that were constructed by non-Muslims with values that are very contrary oftentimes to Islamic values. And we're just, sometimes we take existing arguments and we reformulate them slightly to make them sound like they're coming from an Islamic standpoint. We add some Arabic terms. We find a hadith that is, you know, worded generally enough that it seems like it's supporting that position. But we, in order for us to actually be able to make political arguments and to, one, be taken seriously, and to find people who agree with us who are outside of the Muslim community, in order for those positions to actually gain ground, for in order for us to not be seen as some kind of security threat or as really, you know, trying to transgress that divide between church and state, we have to use their language and we have to use their arguments, and we can't really break out of those culture wars, because there's no point in sitting in the corner and just articulating a completely different position and having nobody backing you up or agreeing with you to an extent when it comes to actually, you know, pragmatically trying to achieve some political change. And that's understandable, but I think it also speaks to how there's that same illusion of us actually being able to practice Islam, and the fact that we genuinely have freedom of religion because we're allowed to wear hijab and we can pray at work. These things are pointed to as examples of the success of the American Muslim community to practice their religion in the United States. And I think it really blurs the fact that there are parts of our deen that, because we ourselves as a community stopped talking about them, we stopped seeing them as part of the practice of Islam. And because of that, we see these examples of private practice as enough to really be able to live out Islam to the fullest. So because on a community level, we rarely talk about things like political Islam, Islamic governance, Islamic principles of economics, even things like civil and marriage law that Muslims really genuinely cannot implement or can't implement openly in the United States, because we just don't talk about these things anymore, we stop seeing them as part of the practice of the deen and as core to our to the practice of our religion. And we convince ourselves that we do have a really significant degree of religious freedom. But I think it's important to remember that what constitutes legitimate religious practice is constructed, obviously, by the system that was constructed in order to support things like white supremacy, like secularism, like imperialism. So yeah, I think it's a really important point to emphasize.
Yeah, reflecting on what you both have said, it's very interesting. I see parallels to other kind of Western minority Muslim communities. What you were just saying there, Sara, about how people feel like, you know, when people think that, you know, we can practice Islam because we have masajid and we can wear hijab and, you know, we have Islamic schools even, and we have access to Islamic education and the tradition, and this is what Islam is. I think that's definitely something that's happened across the Western world, and even in, to some degree, you know, in Muslim countries, where people perhaps aren't aware that Islam actually should encompass all of those things. I wouldn't say it's as prevalent at all in the Muslim world, but unfortunately that kind of secularization of Islam as the same as any other world religion is more of a global project. But I think something that is very emblematic of this, that you touched upon as well, Bethina, in your research, was this kind of question of minority fiqh, right? And this is something that very much people talk about in the UK as well, where there's this idea that, you know, this is something that could be reduced to a fiqh of living in a non-Muslim country. And obviously, that's not to say Islam doesn't have rules about that. But to call it a fiqh on the same level as, you know, a fiqh of salah or a fiqh of tahara, you know, of ablutions and cleanliness, as though it's kind of just almost a bit of a tick box thing that, you know, oh, we know we're allowed to, it's this set of rules and that's it, I think really reduces the political complexities that ultimately this poses for all of our communities. But in terms of particularly, you know, you guys talking about the American Muslim community, I mean, I'm not an American, so I don't want to broad brush or generalize. And, you know, as Bethina rightly said, it's really hard to generalize. And I think my experience of the US Muslim community has been very much that, that, you know, it's very different on different from coast to coast, urban areas to rural areas, north, south, like it, there's a lot of difference. But at the same time, a couple of things that you touched on, Bethina, in your thesis on this, really resonated with just my experience of meeting Americans from different parts of the country. One of them was, you know, this kind of inflated sense of responsibility. And I think, again, that's not something unique to Americans. Western Muslims have this, that, you know, we are in a much better position than everyone else, and we can go out and change the situation for everyone. And sometimes that comes as well with a bit of a more exaggerated perception of how other people see America. I meet a lot of people who really do believe that everyone wants to come to America and everyone has a positive, you know, image of America. But especially, you know, in the past 5 years or so, with just a lot of even just stories about racism making headlines, I think people start to see America as quite different. And, you know, with heightening socioeconomic inequality, things like healthcare, I think, you know, that's not always the case, but it speaks to, again, this idea of just, yeah, exceptionalism, that of course we're the, you know, we're the best country on earth because that's almost how it's been indoctrinated into the population. At least that's how it seems from an outsider perspective. And then this obviously is just, it limits anybody who feels this way, American or not, because it can give way to having ignorance about other communities and negative stereotypes. And again, this is something I see from Muslims generally in the West as well, that their assumption that, you know, Muslims in the Muslim world are somehow less educated about these things, less refined or more backward or more cultural. And we have the advantage by being, you know, born and brought up in the West, that we don't have that baggage. And aside from being, you know, very inaccurate, I feel like that does go against the kind of spirit of Ummah that we're supposed to have. And it really kind of just does buy into the nationalism that I guess is pushed on all of us as part of growing up in you know, the nation state, that these people are like this. And it's a shame when we can't kind of push back against that. But I think that one thing that really stood out to me, and something actually I credit Sara, you know, a lot with introducing me to, was understanding the kind of Black American Muslim experience, and having then, after having otherwise met African American Muslims and learning and speaking to them about their experience and what Black American Islam is. That is something that I found really interesting, and it was something that I think your research also highlighted as something that your respondents, when you interviewed various different community leaders and imams, you know, they identified that the Black American Muslim experience is central to American Islam. But at the same time, that community does not identify as strongly with this exceptionalism. And I think that, you know, from what I've seen generally of their writings and that side of the community, there is more of a resistance because of the experience that African Americans have had over the past three centuries, and the legacy of slavery, obviously, as well, a huge part of that. And it's interesting that that is something that's identified very often as central to American Islam, but
it's not something that I feel infuses perhaps the work of some of the organizations that you've been talking about and the work that they do. As you're saying, you know, it's very much in line with the status quo.
So with respect to the story of Black American Muslims, and then also American Muslims with more immigrant roots, there's within the discussion on exceptionalism or the distinctiveness of American Islam, it's exceptionalism, and then there's this idea that of indigenizing American Islam, and those pieces overlap in terms of localizing or particularizing the American experience. And how much promoting this like indigenized version of American Islam, or the idea that American Islam can take shape differently, is an exceptionalist belief. So one response to this question on an authentic indigenized American Islam, for example, is known to appear in the work of Dr. Omar Farooq Abdullah, who wrote of the imperative of establishing a culturally indigenous Muslim identity in the United States. And he emphasized that it's culture that underpins identity, social cohesion, and true community. And he makes the argument that when Muslims establish that foundation, they'll be able to exert political and social influence. And so he wrote, quote, "The creation of a healthy Muslim American psyche is contingent on the creation of a successful, well-integrated indigenous culture. A well-integrated psyche and unified sense of identity make authentic Islamic religiosity, true spirituality, and moral perfection a normative possibility within the American context." And he substantiated it by drawing on examples from the Sunnah of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, in which he did not reject or forbid local customs and cultures, so as they didn't induce any harm and were compatible with Islamic values, or so long as they did not do so. He draws on classical Islamic law and fiqh that accommodated beneficial aspects of local norms and cultures, and setting limits only when necessary. So an authentic American Islam, in his view, is no different than Islam as it flourished in other cultural contexts. So a well-integrated cultural iteration of Islam in the U.S. Avoids complete assimilation or isolation and appeals to all ethnic and social categories or class categories. So by developing a sound Islamic literacy, he argues, actively partaking in cultural production and, you know, being able to kind of affect change in masajid and other institutions, educational and social institutions, Muslim can actually be empowered to address pressing social and political issues. And, you know, he says that, quote, "true religiosity and deep spirituality require inner consistency and stability, which are only possible in the sound cultural nexus." So he ties the question of culture and also religious practice together. And this is necessary to the flourishing of Islam in the United States. So scholarship that promotes this cultural identity, this distinct cultural identity for American Muslims, lends kind of just this attitude toward the singularity of the American Muslim experience. And what it does is it kind of translates this into a normative command and imperative. So he addresses this authentically indigenous American Islam through a cultural lens, but he doesn't address, you know, what are the pressing social political issues that American Muslims will actually be able to address through this. Now, Dr. Sherman Jackson, American scholar of Islam, he devotes his work, Islam and the Black American, to tracing the history of Islam and Black Americans. And he focuses on the challenge for Black Americans in constructing a distinct identity. Black American Muslims face difficulty in relating to the U.S. and the West in, you know, in a sociopolitical setting that has been influenced heavily by white supremacy. Islam in the United States was characterized by this indigenous Black Muslim presence. And that was reshaped by the post-1965 wave of Middle Eastern and South Asian Muslim immigrants who brought in what he terms hegemonic varieties of Islam. So he responds to this predicament that Black American Muslims face by calling for the indigenization of Islam in the U.S. And he argues that interpretations of Islam were skewed by these, you know, Middle Eastern and South Asian cultural contexts and that are singular and essentializing. He calls for the direct application of usul al-fiqh independent of immigrant cultural influence. And he argues that by returning to the classical Islamic tradition, Black Muslims can then authentically live in the U.S. without compromising their faith tradition. And he makes the distinction between assimilation and indigenization. And he writes that, you know, assimilation kind of implies the absorption of Muslims by the dominant culture. Indigenization, on the other hand, means, quote, embracing America without embracing the false universal. And, you know, that has been put forth by the dominant culture, one that, you know, kind of often, you know, promotes like whiteness and other structures of power. And so like Dr. Abdullah, Dr. Jackson's call is a normative one. And he writes, quote, and yet it's only and precisely by virtue of their conspicuous participation in the American constitutional order that Black American and other Muslims can qualify to enjoy the kinds of rights and protections that make protest and creation of alternative modalities of Americanness even possible. In fact, it may be that these very protections that afford Muslim Americans the greatest ability to rise to their highest selves. And he describes this as, you know, that actually it may very well be a scriptural imperative for Muslims to do this, to promote the Constitution, to protect themselves and, you know, protect their protection, as he says. So while I point to the works of Dr. Abdullah and Dr. Jackson, just to conceptually discuss indigenization, they're just two voices or two interlocutors in this larger discussion. But there's a question, I think, of whether this itself is an exceptionalist viewpoint, especially in the claim that it is through the American constitutional order that American Muslims can, you know, freely and authentically practice Islam independent of overseas context. So there's just kind of that question around indigenization.
Yeah, I find this discussion honestly quite difficult because on the one hand, I understand the pragmatic concerns of Muslims in the United States who want their children especially to grow up being more confident and comfortable in their Islamic identity and not seeing any contradiction between being able to live in the United States and be a successful, productive member of society and at the same time being Muslim and being overtly and openly Muslim. But I think why I don't buy some of the arguments that are made off of the back of, say, papers like Dr. Abdullah's on Islam and the Cultural Imperative is that what I do appreciate is that it highlights a really beautiful aspect of Islam, and it's very optimistic in how it shows that Islam was able to spread to so many different societies and pre-existing cultures that were vastly different, were not a barrier to people seeing the truth of Islam and absorbing it and implementing it in their lives without completely erasing pre-existing culture and like really rich histories that were already in these different regions of the world. But I think that focusing on that and making it seem like Islam is something that when it enters a new society, it fills in the cracks without really changing things too heavily. It improves things without shaking things up too much. When in reality, in the places that Islam did spread, it fundamentally transformed the society. It replaced the political system in a lot of these places. It changed the system of law. It changed how people organize their family life. It even impacted languages. It impacted languages such as Urdu and Farsi and Turkish and other Islamicate languages, if we can call them that, that contain now a lot of Arabic loanwords and even Arabic grammar and script. But it also even replaced the language in many of the places that it spread to. So I think it's important to emphasize that Islam is hegemonic in that sense that it has a very broad spanning system that addresses all of the different parts of human life that is meant to be implemented. And when it's implemented in its full, it doesn't necessarily have to erase pre-existing cultures, but it is extremely transformative and it is hegemonic. It's not something that should be reduced to, again, like a film that can just be gently placed over society without changing it too much. That said, that is the case in places where Islam became the dominant religion, right? And we still need to talk about what to do in the case where we're still living as religious minorities in the United States or elsewhere, and Islam can't be hegemonic here. So what do we do in the meantime? And this is where that important point about the fiqh of minorities comes in, because I think when we talk about coming up with a fiqh for living as a religious minority in the US and coming up with an American Islam and the need for ijtihad in these situations, I think it makes it seem like we are establishing the rules of the game by coming up with rules of what to do and when and what's permissible and what's not. But what is actually happening is that there's already a game, the rules have been set, and we're just trying to decide what moves to make. And we're not even questioning whether the rules are fair or whether this is a game that we want to be playing. And yeah, as much as we don't really have a choice as a community but to make those immediate pragmatic decisions, I don't think that we should make it seem like that what we're living is normal, when really I think that as long as we're living as a Muslim minority in the United States, especially in this political system that is so antithetical to Islam, that we're living in a state of emergency, and we're making rules for what to do in an unideal situation, and we never should make it seem like that this is the norm and this is how Islam should be. And this goes back to the exceptionalism point, where when we come up with a way to live in this state of emergency, in this state of exception, and then privilege that and make it seem like this is what Islam actually is supposed to be, and use that to downgrade how Islam is practiced in majority Muslim societies, I think that that is really problematic for obvious reasons.
Yeah, it is, because I think when it comes to talking about commitments, you know, commitments to like Muslim identity, commitments to American identity, and, you know, the responsibilities that come with, or the commitments that become with being American, I think it speaks to a question that I've been thinking about, is at what point, you know, do certain particularities become more universal? And, you know, what are the claims to like universality that each of these aspects of like our identities or commitments or ethical commitments make? So that's where I think that's the core of the discussion of, you know, ummatic commitments or commitment to the Muslim ummah, rather than like commitment to, you know, a nation state based identity. And so I think that ties in like the question of, okay, well, how does like affiliation, or how does a certain kind of attachment to a sense of, you know, a distinct identity or exceptionalism, how does that relate, or how can that be reconciled with the concept of ummah and the responsibilities toward ummah? And so just to clarify, like what I mean by that is this idea of like, you know, our sense of exceptionalism as Muslims, for example, or Islamic exceptionalism, or Islam's claim to kind of final truth and revelation. So the idea of like the Muslim ummah, for example, being the chosen community, as, you know, substantiated in the Quran, for example, in Surah Ali Imran, believers, you are the best community singled out for people. You order what is right, forbid what's wrong, and believe in God. And then the term ummah in the Islamic tradition carries a significance as this meaning of, as meaning this global, non-territorial community of Muslims that are tied together through their shared commitments. So Tamim al-Barghouti, for example, he defines the term ummah as this ideal defined by shared commitments to the Quran and Sunnah. And he says, quote, each Muslim follows all Muslims, that is a physical existence of individuals that are called an ummah when these individuals have an image of themselves as a collective, and when this image is guiding them to do certain things in certain ways distinct from others. So when it comes to American Muslim exceptionalism, I argue when we are talking about what comes first, this relies often on the United States' sociopolitical setting rather than, you know, an ummatic or Islamic exceptionalism. So notions or attitudes around American exceptionalism are not then informed by Islam's unique relationship to politics, or Islam's universalizing qualities and its, you know, resistance to secularization, you know, in history, for example. If anything, the American and American Muslim exceptionalism qualifies Islam as the source of its, you know, of its unique capacities. So I say that American Islam is exceptionalism because of different reasons, because of its capacity to integrate and, you know, reconcile American political principles. So that becomes the weight then gets put on the American aspect. So it wouldn't be this ummatic commitment or this Muslim imperative, but rather the American identifier that kind of displaces that and what guides priorities. And so where I think the difficulty comes in, you know, with identifying as a distinctly American Muslim as opposed to just a Muslim, or the tension between, you know, the two, is that when you take exceptionalism from this idea like of the particular or local to the global or universal. So as I mentioned, the center of gravity then becomes grounded in the American identity, or America as an idea or a space. And that's what, you know, kind of gives the American Muslim community its exceptional qualities.
Yeah. No, I think you've really touched on the crux of the issue there, which is about how do you kind of scale up that local identity that is very localized, right? And it is entrenched in being American, and then not just being American, but that American exceptionalism to the global level, and reconcile that with other priorities that we would have as Muslims, and that connection with the global ummah. Because both of you have raised like really good concerns around kind of indigenization. And Sara, your thoughts made me think about, you know, a lot of things as to obviously, yeah, how sustainable is is this in the long run? And this is a conversation that we've had, I think, even previously on the podcast about how we as Muslim minorities see the future, right? I remember when we had in our episode with the sisters from Spain, they were also talking about that in the kind of in the European context. But I actually do believe that indigenization otherwise is a good thing on a cultural level. And, you know, for the reason, and this is the reason that many people give in this conversation of look at how Islam spread throughout the world. How did Islam get to Indonesia and India and all of these places, even before necessarily, you know, actual wars and conquering that land? But definitely in the case of like Southeast Asia, it was purely through trade. Right. There are many Muslim majority states today that were never necessarily controlled by a Muslim polity, but Islam reached them through, you know, their interaction with other Muslims and then the indigenization of that culture, such that culture today is very much, you know, an Islamic culture, if we can call it that. But I think you guys have highlighted the concern of in the modern day, under kind of the modern nation state system, that indigenization process becomes much more complicated. And it's the how that I'm concerned about. One of my concerns is as you were saying, Bethina, about how this kind of, how creating American Islam or Western Islam or any other kind of Islam, ultimately, I feel, does necessitate some kind of reform. Because you would be, as you said, focusing more on the American elements or the Western elements, as opposed to grounding it in more Islamic commitments or being heavier on that side. And definitely, I mean, in the UK, this is obviously a big discussion as well. And it is always kind of pitting the local and focusing on local politics and local community concerns and, you know, domestic issues as opposed to the global. And that really results in nothing else but Islamic political quietism. Perhaps, okay, you know, people will be very involved in their local politics or British politics, but they're not concerned with what does Islam have to say about those issues, because they think we're in a non-Muslim country, that's not going to work. My other concern, this is more of, I guess, a social issue about indigenization, is again about how this happens. And I don't know about what you guys think, but I feel like a lot of this indigenization process is happening in our generation today through representation. And this idea that you are part of our community when you are represented, when you have, you know, a Marvel superhero representing your ethnicity and your religious background. And not just even in the necessarily wholly token sense, as in, you know, it's not you as an assimilated person, but you with other aspects of your cultural identity, not your values. Your values are not going to be different to the mainstream, but otherwise, you know, you've been represented, you've been seen, and your particular you know, hybridized identity has been recognized. That shows that you're part of our society and our community now. And that is obviously something, as a representation issue in general, is something that our community is struggling with.
Well, I agree with you, Aisha. I think that the challenge becomes, you know, how to make sense of like in a movement toward indigenization beyond simply acclimating culturally for the sake of our kids, for example, not feeling like outsiders, right? And I think that I would say like that is, you know, the question becomes how much can we particularize a certain like cultural experience. And how do we identify meaningfully with our cultural environment, with our neighbors, and, you know, without, you know, making a normative claim about Islam or, you know, how to think about Islam or Muslim identity. So, for example, like, you know, I'm a Palestinian descent and I grew up in Missouri. And I would say like my, you know, having grown up in Missouri or like very much like Midwestern background, I think that many of my family members would say is very evident in a lot of the things that I do or say or like, you know, right? I think that's inevitable. You know, and that's undeniably like Aisha, you know, I'm sure that there are aspects to, you know, having lived in the UK or brought up in the UK, as I understand it, that you would identify with, or Sada, like, you know, being American and certain things that you would identify with culturally speaking. But, you know, at the same time, I think what's important to bear in mind when it comes to the limitations of these sorts of discussions is that when it comes to like, for example, the nation state, and we know Islam and the Quran and Ahadith recognize the existence of nations and tribes of distinct peoples, right? And the prophets of Islam were sent to different nations before the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. But the modern nation state and nationalism today are different conceptions. So the nation state itself today is a modern phenomenon that requires the commitment and solidarity of its citizens in the form of this nationalism as the self-preserving mechanism. And I think that's important to bear in mind when we're talking about, you know, kind of these sorts of like identities and commitments. And so when it comes to solidarity with other Muslims who share our same creed and ethical commitments, such a solidarity is one that transcends these territorial or state commitments. And I think that's important to bear in mind when it comes to kind of solidarity and community on that basis. And, you know, I think when it comes to like the cultural piece, you know, I think something that I was reflecting on is just my travel, like my traveling for about, I want to say like about 3 years recently, you know, pre-pandemic, which was, I was in Bahrain, I was in Turkey, and I was in Palestine. And when I was in Jerusalem and I was going to go to the Haram and pray in Masjid al-Aqsa, and I got stopped before entering, what language do you think the IDF was in what language do you think the IDF was speaking to me?
Arabic.
They weren't speaking to me in English.
Nope.
You know, although like I was actually speaking, I was trying to speak to them in English. Just, I mean, English is my first language, but they actually, like, you know, they were laughing at me, and they insisted, you know, they kind of insisted on speaking Arabic to me rather than English, even though, you know, I think they very much understood and spoke English. And I think that interaction left a big impact on me in the way that, like, I conceive of myself, like, you know, as American and as Muslim. And yeah, I think that kind of did leave a lasting impact on how I viewed situations like that. And I think something that came up in like a lot of my discussions with leaders in my research was that they actually found, you know, they were reflecting a great deal on like what it meant to be culturally American in juxtaposition to like the cases of other Muslims overseas or like in other contexts when they were in travels.
I think that story of yours is an example of exactly how I feel like going forward, we would be able to navigate this hybridized identity. That, like you said, we can culturally acclimatize to our surroundings. And definitely when we are elsewhere, we perhaps can feel, you know, very American or very Western. I always feel like this. And so many people, they hate the UK, and then you go away for like a week somewhere else and you're like, oh my God, life's so great back home. I mean, I don't actually believe that. But in general, you know, people's being away from home makes you sometimes value things that you didn't realize were important to you. But at the same time, I think we will always be, like Sala said, in that state of emergency, knowing that people will, even if we feel a certain way, that's not going to be recognized by wider society necessarily. And I feel like we have to kind of outgrow that need for validation, for someone else to tell us that we are American, we are British, we are wherever we are from, you know, as a Muslim minority, and know it ourselves, but also know that because of our other allegiances elsewhere, that's always going to be under question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and to further emphasize this point about how I do think that we will still continue to live in this unideal state of emergency, because I think when we start talking about how Islam is fundamentally transformative and it has a political system to implement, people will see that as just irrelevant to the discussion of being a Muslim in the United States, where we will continue to be minorities. And, you know, the pragmatic concerns that we have now are that indigenization. But I think there are two really clear examples of how that indigenization process does not necessarily lead to peace and assimilation and a greater and greater ability to really fully live out Islam in an authentic way. The first example being the Indian subcontinent, where not only did Islam travel and spread very widely, Muslims even ruled the subcontinent at some point. And Islam has been there for so long that you can definitely point to the subcontinent as an example of indigenization. There's very clear examples of local Islamic dress, architecture, food, those, you know, the aesthetic things, but even the underlying values and the fact that there's an extremely rich intellectual tradition from the subcontinent, both in Farsi and in Urdu and other languages. But now what is the situation that Muslims face in the Indian nation state is that they are in a state of emergency. They're in an extreme state of violent emergency because they continue to, as indigenous as they look, as much as they speak and dress and eat the same way that as non-Muslims do in the subcontinent, as long as they hold to their Islamic beliefs, they're still seen as foreigners, as people who need to further assimilate, people who can't live side by side alongside Hindu nationalists. So that is a blatant example of how the indigenization process doesn't fix everything. And another example is in China. And I think this is even cited in Dr. Abdullah's paper as an example of, you know, somewhere that Islam traveled and it became indigenized. And now we have beautiful examples of Islamic Chinese architecture and calligraphy. There are, you know, active Muslim communities, and I'm speaking specifically about within the Chinese nation state and the community that's often referred to as Hui Muslims. And they've been there for centuries and centuries. They have a long-standing cultural tradition and intellectual tradition, and they are currently living under extreme surveillance. They're not allowed to practice their religion in the most basic ways that American Muslims definitely are. And when you see a Hui Muslim, they don't look foreign. They are definitely indigenized. So again, that process of cultural assimilation, it doesn't fix the issue of Muslims actually being able to live side by side with non-Muslims, specifically within the nation state structure, which, you know, this is a bigger topic. And maybe if anybody's interested, they can go to our Islamic governance episode to hear about why that system is in many ways just incompatible with Islam. But to also go back to how I think this affects how Muslims view the rest of the ummah. For one thing, I think this skewed perception of the Muslim world exists where, because American Muslims grow up in a very religiously diverse society, they see themselves as more successful and capable of overcoming things like racial differences and conflict and racism in general, and sectarian differences. And this is something that you mentioned in your paper, Buthaina, with the specific quotes of people saying things like, you know, American Muslims don't have the same sectarian differences, such as, you know, like the Deobandi Barelvi divide is not as big of a deal here as it is even in places like the UK. And for one thing, this, you know, it completely misrepresents the diversity of the Muslim world, how Muslim countries contain religious minorities. They contain a lot of ethnic and linguistic diversity. And historically, not only was the Muslim world religiously diverse, but for a very long time, Muslim polities ruled over majority non-Muslim populations. And I don't think that we can really point to the United States as a more successful example of ethnic and religious pluralism. But also something that is mentioned in your paper is this quote from Yusuf Shahood, who talks about how American Muslim youth are seen as forming a more organic form of religious expression. So they're distinct from previous generations, as well as Muslims abroad. And what underlies this is still that, you know, this exceptionalist attitude towards both the older immigrant generation, who's seen as bringing their cultural baggage, but also towards the rest of the Muslim world, who is seen as having failed to achieve pluralist tolerance and peace in multi-ethnic and multi-sect societies.
Yeah, I second that, Sara. I think I've definitely witnessed as well just an attitude of deference towards Western countries, even not just necessarily Muslims within that, but that, you know, Western countries have achieved a certain, they have achieved something that Muslim countries cannot. You know, they have achieved, like you're saying, you know, this level of pluralism, which Muslim countries cannot, and, you know, Muslim people clearly don't want enough. And they're the reason sometimes why the Muslim world is in strife. There's a lot of kind of pointing fingers going on. And for me, this is why I think these kinds of perceptions can be problematic when we think about the fact that we are supposed to be one ummah.
I think it's important that we don't neglect how American Muslim identity and the public narrative that has been presented has been impacted by structures of power, particularly like structural Islamophobia. And as we know, like Islamophobia is the Islamophobia industry is a multi-million dollar industry, right? And it's not this like Islamophobia is not just, you know, doesn't just occur on the level of like interactionism. And that's important to bear in mind. And so I say in tandem with this, or like perhaps what's leading, what may be at times like leading to this is this kind of strategic fashioning of, you know, the moderate or liberal Muslim category, or like moderate Muslim networks that I think that can't really be, we can't, you know, neglect in this discussion. So for example, like the RAND Corporation, which is a nonprofit global policy think tank that is majority funded by the US government and military and other, you know, government agencies. And they proposed back in the report, I think like in 2007 it was, and they recommended verbatim that, quote, targeting five groups as potential building blocks for networks, liberal and secular Muslim academics and intellectuals, young moderate religious scholars, community activists, women's groups engaged in gender equality campaigns, and moderate journalists and writers. And they wrote, functioning again in this foundation-like role, the United States should assist programs that promote democratic education, particularly programs that derive authoritative teachings supportive of democratic and pluralistic values from Islamic texts and traditions. moderate media, gender equality, and advocacy for moderate agendas. I believe this discussion cannot be divorced or separated from the call of the Muslim community to develop more of a distinct and authentic version of American Islam. Because, you know, the reality is that we, you know, as American Muslims might find ourselves often pushed into the corner where, you know, despite our best intentions, constantly having to justify our humanity and our existence within the language of, you know, the American body politic. And I think that's important to bear in mind when we're talking about this.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wanted to ask you, Aisha, how a discussion like this is unfolding in the UK, you know, whether there are kind of similar, like, you know, trends or like certain sentiments among UK Muslims to move toward, you know, whether it's like indigenization or localizing the British Muslim experience, for example, or if you find that there are kind of different tendencies there. So I was actually interested in hearing more about the UK context.
Yeah, so I think the UK context bears a lot of similarities to the US, but with some key differences. I'd say the similarities are in the government's agenda to try and, as you're saying, as you know, the information that you were just giving kind of from the Rand Corporation, there have absolutely been like equivalents in the UK. I think it was the same year in the 2000s, I think it was 2007, that one of the contest strategies that were released by the government, contest was the precursor to the Prevent program, which is kind of well known now as, you know, a very, very intrusive countering violent extremism initiative. But the precursor to that was this contest document, which was submitted by the government and specifically identified the feeling connected to a transnational ummah as a sign of extremism. And so this attempt to localize Islam and promote a British Islam that was in line with British values was something that very much, I think, characterized, especially in the initial post-war on terror era, a lot of government interactions and interventions in the Muslim community. And to this day, much of that, you know, is still going on. And there are still initiatives and things like that that are sponsored and that in general, I would say that that is something that is being promoted. But I think that, to be honest, the government made a crucial misstep when they introduced it must have been 2015, the Prevent program, but in particular, it was obviously targeting educational institutions. And I remember I was at university when the program came out, and immediately kind of Muslim Islamic societies, which are obviously the equivalent of MSAs, rallied around and created a campaign called Students Not Suspects, which was pushing back against the fact that now, you know, teachers and lecturers were going to have to report on their students if they showed signs of quote unquote extremism. And they felt like they wouldn't be able to participate, obviously, authentically in their lectures, and that they were going to be policed, etc., etc. And that, and then following on from that, being, you know, it being extended to schools at a secondary level, a primary level, really, I think, woke up a lot of the Muslim community and traumatized a lot of people as well, because subhanAllah, a lot of people's very young children were, you know, taken in by authorities and put in de-radicalization programs for things that, you know, we would hear the news that a five-year-old has been, you know, detained by Prevent or reported to Prevent because they spelt cucumber as kookaburra. Right. And somebody, you know, a 3 or 4 year old said Alhamdulillah after they sneezed, and their nursery teacher reported them to Prevent. And so this was a kind of almost France-esque kind of interventionism that we didn't have before. And I think that since then, a lot of people are more woke to the government's agenda in that respect. But at the same time, I think that the indigenization process has happened and is continuing to happen and is successful to the degree that it has severed the ummatic sentiment and people's, I mean, I think people, it's not to say that people obviously don't care about the ummah and that they're not connected to their communities back home. And not to say, of course, that people are not interested as well in what is happening in the Muslim world. Definitely causes that are humanitarian related, things like Palestine, Kashmir, even recently the situation of Muslims in India. It's not that people don't care or they don't get attention, but the idea that we could have any real change or influence that in any way is very minimal. And the only avenues that are ever identified, and I guess it's the same in the US, and I think it was something you mentioned in your research as well, is if we get involved in local politics. But also the idea of getting involved in local politics has been elevated because it's almost evidence of the fact that we are now citizens of this country. And I recently went to an event where a lot of, you know, it was a Muslim youth event, and it was for Muslim kind of youth leaders, actually. And the sister who was introducing the event, you know, stood up and said, I, you know, came to this country as a refugee. And my mother always told me that this isn't your country. You know, we have our country back home that we left, but we're going back there. And so many, I think, were still raised with this idea that we have something back home that we're returning to, which is perhaps a bit different in the US, because I think people went there to stay. I don't know if that was the case with everybody who came to the UK. But now I think that younger generation has realized that no one's going back, and they want to make their mark here, and they want to be participating in every area of life in order to have a say that they believe they rightfully have as citizens. And I personally kind of have mixed feelings about this. On a personal level, I feel very British, and I don't feel like, you know, I will ever be able to call any other place, you know, home or something that's connected so deeply to my identity. But at the same time, I feel like this kind of devotion to the concept of I am a citizen of this state, and I will fulfill all of my rights and responsibilities as a citizen, you know, because I am a citizen of this country, and these are my priorities, these are my people, and these are my loyalties. I find that very hard to accept. And I think that this is where then, as Muslims, we would need to take a step back and recognize that, you know, this nation state system has barely been existence, or not barely been existence, but barely been the norm worldwide for, you know, 70 odd years. And it is not the norm throughout history. It's a very modern phenomena. And we're seeing it breaking down, and we're seeing it failing to actually bring together communities. And instead, we're seeing this increasing polarization. Are we just going to kind of stick our heels in the ground and be like, no, this is the way forward, accept us? Or are we going to think about, what does Islam tell us in this situation? Does it have any guidance for us? Is there anywhere else that our allegiances should lie? Or how should we be thinking about, you know, these issues in the future? I say that from my experience, that's how I would characterize kind of the British Muslim experience in the political realm, at least, and kind of efforts to indigenize Islam at that level. But I really appreciated you bringing up Dr. Omar Farooq Abdullah's book on Islam and the cultural imperative, because I feel like the cultural question also needs to be addressed. And I think that this is something where perhaps American Muslims are more successful, I would say, than UK Muslims. Having said that, you've raised today all of various problems that indigenization could lead to, so I don't want to kind of give a blanket acceptance. But from my experience, I feel like people have less difficulty reconciling an American cultural identity because of various reasons. I think first up, you can become an American, whereas there is still that question in Europe of, you know, can you really become French? Can you really become German or Austrian? And then what does that mean? I mean, when they started the question around British values, which was in an effort to combat extremism, non-Muslims would be talking about this on talk shows and radio stations of what are British values? And it turned into really a kind of pathetic discussion, which had, you know, liberal values on one area. But then in an effort to kind of differentiate it from the US or any other Western society, they had to, you know, people calling up and saying things like, oh, queuing is a British value, you know, standing in line and being patient. Or then it turns into, you know, support for the monarchy. And then that's like a very contentious issue. Not everybody likes the monarchy. And, you know, it just really has not been able to fully be identified, partly because obviously of British history. But I think that this is, again, then more contentious for Muslims because there's perhaps there definitely is a legacy of racism and imperialism with all European states, that minorities who are generally migrating from these countries' former colonies find it difficult to accept. But having said that, I do feel like, you know, there is a way that we as Muslims can embrace aspects of the culture of which we're living in without wholly kind of giving in to either their political roadmap or giving up aspects of our Islamic identity. And I feel that this is often because people don't really necessarily understand what culture is. You know, I hear all the time that people kind of say things like, oh, I don't conflate culture with Islam. And they're not talking about Western culture here. They're talking about, you know, cultures from their countries of origin, usually Muslim majority countries. And sometimes I'm just like, what do you mean by culture? Because culture isn't just the aesthetics. It's not just kind of, you know, your language or your dress. It's not particular customs that people would be able to clearly see, oh, this goes against Islam because the fiqh says this and culture says that and that's wrong. Culture is much deeper than that, so this is a much harder question. And there's something I always refer to in this conversation is Edward T. Hall, who's an American anthropologist, his depiction of a cultural iceberg, which is that, you know, above the water level on the iceberg, you have, you know, these very overt things about a culture like language and dress and holidays, food, literature. But below the water is things like communication style or conversation patterns, humor, values of family and friends, you know, courtesy, manners, gender expectations, even history, pride, beauty ideals, all of these things that actually do determine us. And so I think that Muslims, you know, when it comes to us as Muslims in the West, in this situation now, we need to be able to have cultural literacy to understand the culture of the situation that we're in and recognize which areas can we take from the culture that, you know, that from the cultural context we're living in, and which areas do we need to refer to Islam. Because, yeah, okay, language, literature, dress, all of this stuff, you know, is mubah, right? We can take it from any particular culture. Things even like humor, conversation styles, you know, recognition of the history or particular traditions of that country. Those things are all aesthetics and don't contradict with Islam. But obviously other things like family values and manners, cleanliness, raising children, and a sense of belonging. These are the things that Islam has an input in. And that's why, in general, when you look at Muslim majority countries, you see these things with different flavors, for want of a better word, different colors, but broad similarities across them. And sometimes I feel like people hold on to their cultural aesthetics more than necessarily the values that are Islamically cultural values, which is a little bit of a difficult situation, because people think that, you know, as long as I adhere to this particular clothing or eat this particular food, they're not necessarily conscious of where Western ideals, like these things to do with belonging, citizenship, allegiances, are perhaps being turned in more of a Western direction when they ought not to be.
Right. And I think I would add that I think that it's also like it's really a constant like a challenge and a tension, you know, just byproduct of like diaspora and what happens to subsequent generations, you know, within it. But I think focusing on also like building confidence in our youth, you know, younger generations, and like how when we, you know, try to work to engage in out of the box, you know, capacity building efforts rooted in our tradition or, you know, that kind of identity piece, we have to talk about like the crisis in literacy that's happening with how pervasive like online culture is with encouraging, you know, superficial knowledge of Islamic tradition and what it means to be a Muslim. And I think that that is also largely influencing the identity crisis among American Muslim youth. And I think that where there is a lot of opportunity and hope is actually within the Nomadix Project in a way to start reframing this. You know, seeking to kind of formalize this Ummah-centered discourse and to start thinking about solutions for a lot of the you know, the failures of modernity, and not just for the benefit of Muslims, but inshallah, you know, humanity at large. But, and then this project is, of course, very much in development, but it remains promising and urgent as we see identity and solidarity rooted in like the nation state paradigm, for example, woefully unprepared to tackle and obviously complicit in global challenges. You know, whether it's like, you know, ecological disaster, poverty, violence, among others. So I would point to this project to follow closely to begin providing more resources for us to start thinking about these questions more meaningfully.
Yeah, I agree that there's definitely a source of hope in the Muslim community, in especially seeing how a lot of Muslim youth are becoming more interested in these topics, and especially in just the topic of religious literacy. And what's funny is that when I was reading that example earlier about this claim that, you know, American pluralism has better served the Muslim community and them being able to overcome sectarian differences, and that's why the Deobandi Barelvi divide is not so bad here. As soon as I read that, I thought, I think the reason that that's not a big deal here is because the average American Muslim just has no idea what those things are. And that's because we don't have, you know, as many resources, and we don't invest as much time into studying the religion in order to actually know what the various intellectual traditions within it are. But that's definitely something that can be practically tackled, and that's a source of optimism. But I think another thing is tackling the curse of monolingualism, and this is definitely something that's, yeah, pretty particular to the American experience, which is that Americans largely only speak English. And even people who come from immigrant backgrounds probably only speak their parents' mother tongue to the extent where they can have casual conversations, but that doesn't mean that they actually consume media or read books or study their deen or study anything else in that language. And I think that that's a huge issue in general when it comes to shaping Americans' perception of the rest of the world, but especially in shaping how American Muslims are able to fuel this exceptionalist attitude towards the rest of the ummah, because for one thing, we only hear about the Muslim world in translation and through the filters of Western media. And also because we only receive our religious education from English-speaking scholars. And without diminishing the knowledge and the real accomplishments that these scholars have, I think it's fair to say that who becomes popular and why they become popular in the American cultural sphere is largely dependent on who either serves the interests of American nationalism or at the very least doesn't subvert it or threaten it in any way. So that further filters how we access our deen by the fact that we can only access it in English through those particular scholars. And this has been just really eye-opening for me recently, because the more that I studied Arabic and made an effort to read and listen to things in Arabic, it opened my eyes to how much I was missing out on and how easy it is to live in a bubble and to lack a broader vision about the ummah, because we're so limited in the ways that we can even engage with it just because of that linguistic barrier.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the most important thing that perhaps our communities are lacking, which is why we're turning towards localizing our ambitions, is that we lack a sense of vision. We lack a broader vision that we as Muslims can get behind and focus on. And that's a very powerful, like having a vision or having a project in that sense is extremely powerful in terms of forming like national identity. That's why they talk about how in international relations, like articulating and the other is the biggest unifier of a society, because that's, you know, everybody is geared against the Soviet Union or China or, you know, Osama bin Laden or something like that. Like it's a very big unifying factor. And I think that as Muslims, we're not sure what should our focus be, what should our vision be. And so we start kind of giving ourselves different priorities at a local level versus a global level, and we start making these kinds of divisions. And I think that something we've reiterated on the podcast before is that, you know, all kinds of work are needed. You know, we as Muslims, we need to excel in numerous different areas, and we need to provide in different ways to our community. And local needs are obviously at the forefront of our attention because they're present in the communities that we live and work in. But at the same time, I think that having that global vision is needed in order to be able to articulate our futures. And I think that this is where people feel, you know, quite precarious. And alhamdulillah, you know, Bethany, you've been talking about the Umatics project, and I've been really happy to be able to work with you guys as well. The vision that having an Umatic frame gives, and then, you know, positing and looking for and calling on Muslims to actually contribute to solutions that look at particular phenomena in the Muslim world, or more generally on a theoretical level, the kinds of ideas that we need to mainstream, the kind of scholarly and academic work that we need to build upon, and really as well stating unification as something that is a very tangible something that is a very tangible concept to identify, I think gives us something to work towards. And I pray that inshallah in the future, work that's coming out of the project and inshallah the institute is able to show people that and show Muslims that we can rally around a vision like that while still providing for our local community needs. It doesn't need to be either or. Actually, they're interconnected. You know, by strengthening the iman and the conviction and the practice of our local communities, we can contribute to inshallah a broader vision that helps our brothers and sisters around the world, and inshallah, you know, us and as minorities in different parts of the West as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think the the limits to having these sorts of discussions, which I think actually makes the need for, you know, emetic discourse and kind of developing that more important, is that we're often limited to the critique that is based in our like respective academic disciplines in which we've studied, right? And I think when it comes to like emetics, is being able to actually formalize, you know, alternative ways of thinking about these same issues in terms, you know, more closely connected to, you know, our like history and tradition and the like. So I think that that's important to kind of keep in mind when we're talking about this. Yeah, that's where the opportunity lies. And I find like, even when I'm talking about this, it's actually very easy to critique. But I think that putting like, to start active, you know, are actively thinking about solutions is actually where the real work and challenge lies.
Yeah, totally. And in the spirit of emphasizing working towards solutions, we'll go ahead and add in the description links to the Omatics project, which both, alhamdulillah, both Thena and Aisha have been contributing to, and they've been putting out a lot of good work. But I think that, yeah, it's important to emphasize that that's kind of the intellectual projects that are important for us to engage in and to contribute to, and to also think about how we can carry those things into more localized forms of practical action, inshallah. But with that, we will go ahead and wrap up this really fascinating discussion. I want to thank you, Buthaina, again for joining us. We really appreciated the opportunity to be able to read your research and to discuss it with you. And we hope that other people also are able to benefit from your work in the future, inshallah. We also encourage everybody to check out the Qarween Project website for our articles, which constitute the bulk of the project in addition to the podcast, and to also sign up for the Qarween newsletter, where we do sum up the previous month's content from TQP, but we also share a lot of things from around the Muslim web and from other resources. And with that, jazakumullahu khairan for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.